Welcome to the Health Design Podcast. Here's your host, Moyez Jiwa.
Estella Lugo was born with an inherited neuropathy and lifelong disability. Despite the physical limitations, she has become a leading patient advocate with an irrepressible positive view of all that life has to offer. Here to share her story is Estella Lugo. Estella, you're very welcome to this call. I'm delighted that we had the chance to connect on the Health Design Podcast. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Moyez. It's an absolute pleasure, and I'm excited to speak with you today.
Like many of our previous guests, you have a chronic illness, which people may not have heard of. So I'll let you explain what it is that you're living with and how that diagnosis was made.
I was born with Charcot-Marie-Tooth disease, named after the three doctors who discovered it. It is not a dental disorder, even though the branding for the name could use some help. And what it is, it's an inherited neuropathy. And in many cases, it's passed on from family member to family member. In our case, speaking on behalf of my sister and I, both of us were born with it. Both of our parents had a spontaneous mutation. They were not affected. No one else in our family were affected in any way, but they were both carriers of this specific mutation that causes CMT. And there are over 136 known mutations that cause CMT, and we're discovering more and more every day. What that really meant for my sister and I growing up in the 80s was my parents started noticing I was the older child. At around 3 or 4 years old, I started tripping a lot more frequently than most children. And they took me to a neurologist, and I was one of the lucky patients, I say, now looking back on hindsight, that was diagnosed as a child. And right away, they thought it was CMT. They ran some tests, some EMG reports on my nerves, nerve conduction testing on my legs, and diagnosed me clinically with CMT. And from that point, I was put in leg braces. So around kindergarten, which around the age of 5 years old, I was wearing leg braces, AFOs, bilateral, full time. And then my sister was born. And they started noticing about 2 years later when she was walking that she was also tripping and walking in a similar fashion with drop foot. And she was diagnosed shortly after.
What was it like for your parents at the time? So here they had a child who was tripping all the time, and they probably had never heard of CMT. What was that journey like for them? You said you were lucky to have the diagnosis.
It's a rare disease. So even now, many people go a decade or more with that being misdiagnosed or going undiagnosed. So I consider ourselves very lucky to be diagnosed in the 80s with a rare disease. But for them, not that we really knew it growing up because we were young and they didn't show their much of their dismay or sadness to us, but they recall it being very scary. They didn't know anything about this disease. It was under the muscular dystrophy umbrella at the time. So they were aware of the Jerry Lewis telethon and most people's exposure to what muscular dystrophy was. And that was really scary for them because they were imagining the worst and their daughters losing mobility and having to rely on a wheelchair and all of those unknown challenges that they would have growing up. But coming from my family backgrounds, very close-knit Puerto Rican family. My father was born in Puerto Rico. My mother was born in New York. Both sides of my family come from Puerto Rico and very much the typical strong family foundation. So we were really fortunate enough to have that support from both of my parents. And we were actually encouraged to put ourselves out there. And when I was around 5 or 6 years old, my mom came across an ad for MDA, looking for a poster child for Long Island, New York, where we grew up. And she submitted my photo. And a few weeks later, we heard back and they had selected me to be the poster child of Long Island. And that was really a pivotal moment, I believe, for our entire family, because it took us from this very isolated place of not knowing any other families with disability or muscular dystrophy or Charcot-Marie-Tooth, and kind of threw us into the nonprofit world, where we were literally attending and planning fundraising events every weekend. And this went on for a decade. So from around the age of 6 and 7, well into our teens, we were heavily involved in the Muscular Dystrophy Association. We were speaking in front of people. We were dancing in front of crowds of high school students at dance-a-thons. We were embraced by a community of people who accepted us, who were on a similar mission of finding treatments and cures for all the different types of muscular dystrophy. And my parents became part of this community and almost like a family. People we were spending every weekend with became like our extended family. And it really brought the sense of pride and community around growing up with a rare disease.
I want to explore this a little bit more with you. You talk about being embraced by a community, being part of something bigger. How important is that in rare disease? How important is that, particularly in Charcot-Marie-Tooth?
It's vital. It's critical to our emotional wellness, because not only do we have the physical challenges of a disease, but there's so much emotional challenge there, especially with a disease that's not well known, that many doctors don't know how to diagnose, let alone treat. And especially growing up with this as a kid, and you're the only kid in your high school with a disability, it can be very isolating. And things like the summer camps that my sister and I went to, it like normalized disability for us and really showed us and opened our eyes up to the diversity of disability, made us feel like we belonged somewhere, where so many times when you're living with disability or an illness that no one can relate to, you feel like an outsider. You know, we couldn't continue pursuing sports. We couldn't continue going to the dance classes or performing in the dance recitals because it's progressive. And so with all of that grief and loss that comes with disability, it's so important to see the other side of that, see role models and examples of people thriving and adapting, and despite all of their challenges, doing incredible and powerful things in the world. And that's really what that brought to our family.
You talk about being diagnosed in the 80s, when none of this would have been available to people newly diagnosed to the condition, even supposing the diagnosis was made in any sort of timely fashion. What is it like today? Is it more likely that people are going to get the kind of support that you are now talking about?
Yes and no. Depending on the country that you're living in, whether you're living in a more populated city or a more urban or rural area, you're going to have different access to care and diagnosis depending on your economic background, your ethnicity, all of the other elements that unfortunately put up barriers to care and diagnosis. We still see on a day-to-day basis so many individuals struggling to understand whether they have this diagnosis, how to get genetic testing. When they do get the testing, how do they interpret those results? Where do they go to find a doctor that knows about that their disease? Where do they go to get the right type of bracing, or what medications should they steer clear of? What medications can help their pain? Who are the best surgeons in the country that can correct deformities? What kind of accommodations should they ask for in school for their children? How do they navigate the world? And that's really been one of the key focuses of the work that I do with, through our foundation, and that our foundation does, aside from all the research for potential treatments, is just building this roadmap for people to connect to resources from people who can understand their experience and can empathize and can speak on behalf of what's worked for them, what hasn't worked for them, and to listen in a way that they don't feel like they're just talking to someone who's going to dismiss their symptoms or gaslight them. So I still feel like we have a lot of work to do. It is getting better in some aspects as far as genetic testing is becoming much more affordable, so more people can access that nowadays. Still in other parts, I still feel like we haven't really innovated much in things like leg braces or physical therapy guidelines, all of those things that I remember growing up with challenges, I still see them today. And so we really try to create those resources that we all wished we had growing up.
The Health Design Podcast is hosted by the Journal of Health Design, an alliance with Unfixed Media and Metal Health.
I know that you have a background in design and marketing, and I want to pivot slightly and talk a little bit about that. What you're describing is unusual in the sense that it's, as you say, a rare condition. And yet, some of the principles that you describe, the things that actually help patients, are very clear in the way that you articulate them. What does a roadmap look like? How do we get to the point where this acts as a template for other rare conditions and how we approach patients and how we support those patients through those illnesses?
One of the biggest shifts that I've been lucky enough to see in the recent years is patient-initiated care and resources, whereas in the past we had to rely on doctors to order a genetic test for us, or we had to rely on one doctor to give us all of the resources that we would ever need for this disease. And many times those pictures can be very bleak. We hear time and time again saying, oh, I left my doctor's appointment in tears because they told me that there's nothing that they can do for this disease, that there's no cure, so there's no point in getting a genetic test, and I should just stop working, and I'm going to be in a wheelchair for the rest of my life, and I'm going to have to live off a disability. These are real life stories that we hear often, unfortunately, and it breaks my heart. And so what I think is been one of the most exciting developments is with social media, with the internet, now we're able to empower patients, give that a kind of cut out our reliance or minimize our reliance on one or two doctors and really amplify the voices of key thought leaders, of expert clinicians, and make that available to people who may not have that information available to them in their city or through their doctor. For instance, you no longer need a doctor to write a script for your genetic testing. We recently developed something we call the CMT Genie, and that is done through a virtual genetic counselor where the patients can set up an appointment with us. We will send them a link to a genetic counselor. They meet with the counselor. If they qualify, they get a testing kit sent to their home, and then they send back the saliva kit, and within a few weeks, they have their test results, and then they can rely back on us for accurate interpretation of that genetic report. And then along with that, we talk to them. We ask them, how are you doing? What are you struggling with? And we connect them with relevant resources that can really impact their daily life, whether that's a neurotoxic drug list or whether that's a type of leg brace that they didn't consider. And a lot of it is not just giving them PDFs and links and literature to read, but hosting webinars and sharing real life stories of success stories of patients and community leaders and making them feel like they can navigate this. This is something that they have the power to do and to thrive despite the challenges of their disease.
Thank you. And I want to reflect back to you what we said all along, which is that this is a template for other illnesses, not just the particular condition that you're talking about, to get an earlier diagnosis, to get the treatment that is up to date, that is informed, and where the person and their family in particular feel supported. I want to explore a little bit with you the potential for this to be utilized in other conditions. Do you see that happening anywhere else?
I think it absolutely is a framework for many, many different types of diseases. In fact, we've presented to a few other disease groups and organizations to break down our structure and how we've done things and how we've built the infrastructure of things like our patient registry, which is something that has become more and more utilized now that pharma and industry are really starting to recognize the value of patient-reported outcomes and patient-reported natural history studies and all of the things that are not necessarily your status quo when it comes to preparing for a clinical trial. But because we've built and we continue to expand what we call the Global Registry for Inherited Neuropathies, it's built on the Matrix platform. And the Matrix platform supports many, many other types of disease types. So this is absolutely something that can be applied to any type of organization. And within the platform, they have translation surveys built in different languages so that when you do have a rare disease, it's important that you reach as many people and you collect as much data as possible. And why confine that just into the US? Why not expand to all of the rare disease patients across the globe to really gather rich data and try to collaborate and accelerate things as quickly as possible? And so the registry does a beautiful job of allowing us to do that and now incorporate those genetic reports that we are collecting through our program. And now patients can literally upload their genetic reports after they go through our testing program. And we have an expert on our team that can help translate those reports and curate them. And now we have something that we can present to researchers that will help make our case for how more frequent this disease is than previously thought. And so that's how you really amplify the voices of rare disease patients is proving and showing that there are much more of us out there than people realize, and that our disease is worth investing in and collaborating with us on and developing treatments for.
The Journal of Health Design, fostering collaboration, amplifying the voice of health advocates, growing a network to improve outcomes in healthcare.
Estelle, I'm still thinking about that four-year-old girl who was tripping and whose parents brought her to a neurologist and had the diagnosis. Where to from here for you? You've clearly done an awful lot of work over the years. So what does the future look like for you?
The future is exciting. We've made a lot of progress, and I think we continue to exponentially move towards real potential cures and treatments in the next few years with the help of AI and digital wearables and remote clinical trials and all of the exciting science that's coming out. And I'm really fortunate to be working with a team of innovative thinkers. I think a lot of times in rare disease, we kind of get stuck in our own bubbles and we don't really veer off or collaborate with other scientists outside of our quote unquote specialty. And a lot of times that's where the innovation happens, is doing things differently, but in a way that the future is going towards. So for me, I continue to work tirelessly with H&F team and amplify the voices of patients and help them navigate all of the challenges ahead. It's exciting, and never in my wildest dreams as a child did I think that I would be able to make a career out of my experience with this disease. I always thought of it as something that I would have to work around. Originally, I wanted to be an interior designer, actually a fashion designer, but because of my hand weakness, I didn't think sewing or cutting fabric for many years was going to agree with me. So I have always had a love for all things creative, and what a better way to use your creative skills than to put them towards something that is going to make a real impact in the world.
Estelle, I suggest that yours is a huge loss to the fashion industry. What is the secret of your resilience? What is it that gets you through the darkest moments, both of this illness, but also of the challenge that you face in establishing all that you've established to support your peers?
I want to say it's been a blessing and a curse to have a sister who shares this disease. It's nothing that our parents or any parent would wish on one child, let alone two. But because we've grown up with this disease together, I've never, and I don't think she has, have ever really truly felt alone in the world. So she is a huge support system in my life. And of course, my family continues to be my partner and my children and all of the people that I've met along the way. All of the people that were helping us and volunteering with us at the telethons decades ago, to all of the families that I meet every year through the foundation, and all of the people that I connect with virtually, and all of the disability influencers online breaking barriers every day, whether that's through adaptive fashion or that's through policy on Capitol Hill for more accessibility and more disability rights. I'm fortunate enough to be completely immersed in this community and, no pun intended, have embraced it to be an asset. And so I no longer carry around that shame. And when you don't carry around that shame, life becomes a lot lighter and you can move a lot quicker and enjoy life. And so that's been where part of the journey so far.
So how can we support you? How can our listeners espouse your cause, and where can we find you, and what can we do to help?
They can visit hnf-cure.org to learn more about the Hereditary Neuropathy Foundation, to gain access to all the resources and research that we've been doing through that website. They can also subscribe to my podcast with my partner, Lainey Ishbia. We have a podcast called Embrace It, where we interview disability advocates from all over the world doing incredible things. And so we don't just speak with people living with CMT, but all different types of disability. And I think when we have a better understanding of how huge the disability community and the demographic is, at 15% of the world, 1.3 billion people on the planet, we can really start to feel like part of a movement and a larger community. And so they can subscribe to that podcast, and they can visit embraceit.life. Lainey and I host workshops for organizations, for people with disabilities, or for brands that are organizations just looking to start the conversation around disability. We have 101 workshop called How to Talk to Anybody About Disability, which really starts to make people more comfortable talking about it so that they can activate change internally and then hopefully continue to do so externally to their customers and all of their followers. You could find me on any of those channels, and then our social media is connected to those websites as well.
We will make sure that all of these details are in our show notes. Acela, you've been eloquent, you've been thoughtful, you've been inspiring, and it's been a huge honor to share your story on the Health Design Podcast. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
The Health Design Podcast, serving patient and physician advocates. Visit us at journalofhealthdesign.com.